Usually on Change Surfer Radio, I am interviewing a guest. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We'll also be available at IET.org. I'm being interviewed by Thomas Pochari, who is the person who runs the website worldaffairsmonthly.com, and he puts out a podcast from there as well. He is interested in technology issues and politics, and I think we had a fairly interesting conversation, and I'm delighted that he is okay with us jointly broadcasting this. So without further ado, this is a conversation between myself and Thomas Pochari of World Affairs Monthly.
This is World Affairs Monthly, and I have Mr. James J. Hughes on the line. He's the Director of Institutional Research and Planning at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And he is the Executive Director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, also in Hartford, Connecticut. He's the author of Citizen Cyborg, Why Democratic Societies Must Respond to the Redesigned Human of the Future, published by Westview Press in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2004. And Trinity College can be found on the net at trincoll.edu, and I'll spell that, trincoll.edu. And the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies can, of course, be found on the net as well, and that's IEET.org. James, it's great to have you on the line, and I think this topic that we will discuss today is probably, it could be the most important topic anybody could discuss.
I'm glad to be here today, Thomas. Could you introduce yourself to my listeners as well?
Of course. My name is Thomas Pochari, and I publish and edit World Affairs Monthly, which is on the net at worldaffairsmonthly.com, and I've been doing this, quite a while now. It seems like an eternity. I started publishing, I went up on the net in March, April 2002, and so it's been a while, but sometimes these kind of projects take a good long while to actually develop and bring to fruition, which is proven to be the case. But it's great to have you, James. And I was quite keen to get you on the phone because I thought that for the past couple of years we are speculating that something. Pretty extraordinary could happen in the next few decades, that is for the human animal. And, this Ray Kurzweil, the computer scientist, has argued that something like singularity is on the horizon. And driven primarily by the computing power, I kind of think quite the opposite. I think it's not going to be computing power that's going to do it. It's going to be actually our own brain power, our own ingenuity and our own ability to figure things out with the computer as a tool or instrument. So it would be really interesting to get your take or your interpretation of what you think is coming. Speculate about this future, and then, of course, discuss, as you do in your book, what we ought to do to prepare for this new human future, which I think you call the transhuman future.
Well, my background is as a sociologist, so all of my technological speculation has to be taken with a certain grain of salt that I'm not really an engineer or a biologist or anything like that. But I'm not sure that that's actually that much of a deficit because my experience with most lab scientists, most scientists who actually have hands-on experience, is that they're so consumed by the difficulties of doing day-to-day science and of making day-to-day progress that they really lack a long-term perspective on the potential for accelerating change. And I do believe in Kurzweil's general notion, which is not, which is shared widely, of accelerating change. So I think that there is this kind of discontinuity. There's a nonlinear nature to the nature of technological change that makes it difficult for most people to wrap their mind around how quickly things could get strange. The other thing that, your question about whether it's simply going to be computing power or other kinds of technologies, other kinds of changes, on the one hand, I'm a convergenist, and that is that I think that many of the different kinds of technologies, especially the molecular technologies, are going to be converging in ways that accelerate the innovation in sciences in ways also that break down current disciplinary boundaries. So in other words, genetic engineering and nanotechnology currently two fairly separate endeavors, but we're already seeing nano engineers beginning to use DNA and biological organic processes, reverse engineering viruses, synthetic biology, and so forth, in ways that will converge biological engineering and robotic engineering. So I think that, you know, in the future, we may not make some of the distinctions that we currently make about different kinds of technologies.
Yeah.
Part of my perspective was shaped by the National Science Foundation's NBIC initiative back started in 2002. Which was the Nano-Bio-Info-Cogno Convergence Initiative. And they brought together scientists from all these different spheres and said, if you were able to make use of one another's innovations in these different fields, how might it enhance the human condition? And and people really began to imagine that accelerating change in a fruitful way back 8 years ago. So in long and short of it is that my principal concern as a sociologist and as a bioethicist has been on how it's going to impact the lived experiences of human beings around our health, our abilities, our cognition, our longevity. And so I've been very consumed with the kind of transhuman or posthuman sets of debates.
Okay.
And an advocate for people's right to make use of these technologies in ways which may violate some people's sense of what's decent, good, and human.
Oh, sure, because one way to describe it would be perhaps to look to the enhancement of our powers, right? Enhancement of our health, enhancement of things in general. But I just thought before I called you up, I thought of two phenomena that I thought I'd point out here, and it's kind of interesting. These two phenomena I'd like to get your comment on them. The first one is what Dick Myers and I were discussing some months back. Richard Myers is a retired four-star general and was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for George W. Bush, when Bush was president, of course. And he was kind of a well-placed guy in the Pentagon for a while, and he admitted to me that during the development of the Internet by the Pentagon and DARPA, of course, and during the development of GPS by the Air Force, that pretty much most everybody working on these technologies at the time did not really understand or could not have predicted what they would end up being for us and how they would actually work for us and basically they're the end product. They didn't understand it and they didn't predict it. Now the second phenomena is that there is this pretty consistent desire to not see new powerful technologies develop. I guess you would call it the Luddite phenomena. In history there's clearly an effort when a new idea comes out, say, for example, Henry Ford thought, okay, I'll make these automobiles, but I'm going to use an assembly line. And most everybody thought it was a crackpot right away. And, of course, when the Wright brothers put up their first flights, people really didn't understand what it was. And they actually waited 4 or 5 years before they went over to France and they got funding in France to actually develop the technology. But so what would you say about these two phenomena, James? I mean, you agree that they sort of, raise a lot of questions?
The first being that people innovate with unintended consequences that they can't foresee the consequences of.
And not only that, but we may be working on something, but no one really truly understands what it is. The rare individual might, but most everybody just doesn't realize what they have.
And the second being that there's an irrational Luddite resistance to a lot of change out there.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think those are both givens so far as the history of technology goes that, when we invented the automobile, we didn't foresee global warming and auto accident fatality rates and urban congestion and the spread of suburbia and all the different things that were sequelae to that.
Yeah. We didn't have the foresight to see much of that at all, right?
Right. Yeah, and you know, as much as I am in the business of trying to encourage anticipatory democracy, encourage foresight, technological foresight, I don't think that in the end it's terribly successful. I mean, we just do the best that we can.
Yeah.
You know, if we were to come up with some of the transhuman innovations that I think are ends and goods in themselves, such as that people be smarter and live longer, they will have consequences for society that I have not yet imagined, that no science fiction author has ever imagined. And for me, the touchstone is, you know, speculative fiction. If you go back to the science fiction of the 50s, 60s, 70s, they imagined a future with computers and where everything was run by computers, but the computers were the size of buildings.
Yeah.
They weren't, you know, shrunk down to, you know, being the size of a nose ring. So the consequences of that are completely different. And nanotechnology is a very recent notion, the notion that we might have nanobots, you know, infiltrating people's bodies and doing things with them. It's a fairly recent technological idea, and it wasn't even in speculative fiction.
Right.
So, you know, we have a very poor track record on that kind of thing.
We do.
Conversely, if you go back, and recently the papers of Robert Boyle, a British founder of British science from the 17th century, his papers were published where he had given a series of 25 wishes that he to the Royal Society of London, of the UK, which was the first scientific organization in the world, really.
Sure.
So he wanted, there were 25 things that he wanted them to work on. And there were things like drugs to alleviate pain, drugs to induce dreams, the ability to swim underwater unassisted, or to be able to stay underwater for a long time, to fly.
Yeah.
Of all the things that he imagined 350 years ago, almost all of them have been accomplished by science subsequently. So, you know, I think what we have to, and what I do in Citizen Cyborg is I say, what are the fundamental human aspirations that we want to fulfill? And is there any technological barrier between that, you know, for the speed of light is probably a given for the foreseeable future. So even though we might want to get to the stars faster than that, there are some physical boundaries that we won't be able to get past. But there's no physical boundary to us living 200 years. There's no scientific or engineering boundary to us being able to colonize the solar system. So if there's a human motivation, you know, we want to be happier, we want to live a long time, we want to be healthier. Yeah. All these are fundamental human motivations. We will accomplish something.
Sure. Pardon the expression, if we put our mind to it.
If we put our mind to it and our resources, exactly.
Yeah. And there's a good question. Are we showing signs of putting our mind to it and devoting the resources, adequate resources, do you think?
Well,
I mean, how would you criticize our efforts so far?
Well, I am a big advocate for more targeted investments in all of these endeavors. I think, for instance, we need to have more targeted investments in longevity medicine because we're facing this huge demographic bulge of older folks.
Yeah.
And if they get sick and disabled at the rate that their parents and their grandparents did, we're going to be broke. So they need to be aided to become to stay as healthy and able and participatory in society as they possibly can be, so that they don't use all those nursing resources and medical resources.
You don't think we're really doing this enough?
I think that instead of the National Institute of Aging spending so much money on Alzheimer's research and cancer research, that's, you know, just a fraction, you know, 10% of the NIH's budget should be put towards anti-aging medicine, which would have the benefit of reducing, you know, once those drugs and therapies were rolled out, they would have the benefit of reducing the incidence of aging, Alzheimer's and all the other diseases of aging.
Yeah.
So that's an example of an extremely cost-effective redirection of our resources if we simply had the vision to make those kinds of investments. Similarly, I think that there are certain kinds of risks that humanity faces, which most people don't and can't wrap their mind around. Many people have been able to focus on the risks of climate change for now.
Okay.
But there are the risks of asteroid impacts. There are the risks of solar flares. There are the risks of super volcanoes. There's all kinds of natural risks that we face, and we need to be to have better monitoring systems. We need to have more resilient civilization. It was one of the catchphrases that I've begun to think more about, how we can become, as a civilization, more resilient in the face of all the different kinds of challenges and crises that we might face.
Right. So in other words, look for some way to protect ourselves against the multitude of potential catastrophes.
Exactly. You know, it's not that I'm a survivalist, and I don't think everybody needs a fallout shelter or something that.
But I mean, we should be aware of what perils are out there, possible perils.
First be aware of it, and then think consciously about the fact that all of our health systems and energy systems and food distribution systems need to be thought of in terms of the fragility of our current international supply and maintenance chains. You know, that we need to have, we could use our contemporary technologies in ways that made communities more self-reliant in the face of the collapse of general social order.
Okay.
And so that's one of the directions I think we need to be thinking in.
You know, it's pretty clear that most scientific research and R&D takes place in the United States or in Western Europe or, of course, in Japan. You know, most of the patents coming out in the world are from these three regions. And yet, you know, you could argue, you know, pretty persuasively by now that these three places are broke, financially broke. I mean, how is the Royal Society of London in London there, you know, founded by Sir Isaac Newton, how is that going to continue when we're sort of financially strapped and even on the edge of bankruptcy?
Well, I'm always a little skeptical about the notion that we're so financially broke and strapped, because I think that there are a lot of spare resources. You know, there is a lot of wealth out there. In the first place, you know, you and I have probably different ideas about progressive income tax, but the highest rates of income tax, the highest wage earners were paying, you know, upwards of 90% income tax under Eisenhower.
Sure.
And that's down to 30% or so now.
Ronald Reagan changed all that, of course.
He changed all that, and I don't think it was for the better. I mean, one of the consequences of that has been the incredible explosion of inequality in the United States.
And of course, our debt.
And our debt.
We don't have the money to pay the bill.
That's right. There's been an increase in the debt. So, you know, I think that it's not just that the wealthy have money that we could take and use for good social purposes, but I think that in general, our economy has been impoverished because, you know, there's only so many yachts that you can buy. There's only so many ski trips that you can go on.
Okay.
Folks at the bottom, you know, spend their money. Yeah, they're suffering and they could spend that money.
Well, so, I totally agree. I mean, I sympathize with that, obviously. I just wonder, you know, now that we have a global economic system, if you start taxing heavily, you know, somewhere, say in the U.S., I mean, the money is just going to go elsewhere. You know, that seems to be, that could be a consideration.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, part of the dilemma that we're in is that in an increasingly globalized world, capital has become so mobile that if any country wants to have good environmental policies or worker policies or you know, fair wage restraints or whatever, capital will flow around the world. So I think that we need, you know, these policies to be global, negotiated at the global level, G20 at least level.
I mean, you can't really have a nation like India doing a lot of, you know, bad things when everybody else wants to be good, because the money will just go to the bad places.
Right, exactly.
So, well, what are the risks do you see out there right now? I mean, for example, James, what if we had talked, say, back in 06, 07, when I think I planned to talk to you in 07 or 08, you know, before the so-called meltdown, you know, what were you thinking back then compared to right now? You know, now that we've had this, I don't know what you want to call it, a crisis where, you know, we really are kind of facing up to the fact that, you know, maybe things are a bit more fragile than we had figured.
Well, I started thinking about fragility of civilization back in the 70s.
Wow. Right?
I mean, I've always had that kind of apocalyptic side to my personality.
Okay, so kind of a survivalist type of mindset.
Well, I think it was really Ronald Reagan who set me off. I thought that the world was going to end under his regime.
Yes.
And I started to study what the ideal commune would be to live in a rural redoubt someplace. And that was what led me into sociology, my first paper.
I'm sorry, Jane, but kind of like in the style of your mother, who was obviously pretty forward-thinking.
She was, in fact. Yes, she was. And and she encouraged me in those pursuits.
Yeah. So you've got some of her traits, which is commendable. However, did Ronald Reagan, in your opinion, now that you've got hindsight, did he turn out to be as bad as you first thought or first feared?
Well, in terms of nuclear negotiation, you know, the whole Reykjavik settled that down a little bit.
Yeah.
What was that, the SALT Treaty or the START Treaty? I can't remember now. But, it wasn't quite as bad in retrospect as I had feared when he was first elected there.
Okay.
In terms of the social policies that Reaganism affected, again, I'm...
Inequality is obviously a big problem.
Right, still.
And it's getting worse by the day as we speak.
Right.
Now, you know what? Technology and, you know, the Kurzweil thesis or even my arguments would appear to be the way forward for us. You know, if we're going to level the playing field and give everybody opportunity, I would think it's our knowledge and our technology which will be the key variable there.
Well, you know, the movement that I have been a part of now for 10 years called the transhumanist movement, it's really an inheritor of this 300-year-old enlightenment optimism that science, technology, reason will be able to get us out of the messes that we find ourselves in, that we'll be able to, you know, have a steady progress because of human reason. But the flip side of that is that we have to apply reason to our social affairs as well. And so one of the things that's distinctive about the group that I run, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, is that our perspective is called now techno-progressive, to distinguish it from the transhumanist ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the techno-progressive idea is that you can't just have technological progress without social progress as well, that the two are complementary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, you could have the most technologically advanced dictatorship, and then all of the technology will be used to the purpose of human subjugation. And conversely, you could have, you know, perfectly participatory and transparent democracy, but if it's poor and, you know, free of all technology, it's not going to be, you know, satisfy very many needs.
Yeah.
So the two have to be, to merge hand in hand, and that many ways are complementary. So I wouldn't say simply that there's a techno fix for the kinds of problems that we face.
Sure.
But, you know, so to give you an example, I think that if you face, you know, we do face some biosafety questions out there, some bioterrorism and emerging novel infectious diseases that just emerge spontaneously. And part of the answer is a techno fix in that we have now miniaturized ability to detect pathogens and to figure out what their genetic codes are and to develop in a speedy way vaccines for them and other kinds of treatments for them. And we have improvements in emergency medical assistance for people who come down with those diseases and so forth. But we have also the political, you know, when China was in the middle of their outbreak of SARS, they tried to suppress the information about it. So you need transparent political transparency so that people are able to share information about disease outbreaks around the world.
Sure.
You need to be able to get the resources to the places that they need to go and then have them not be, you know, taken aside by corrupt governments or local warlords or whatever.
Sure.
So there's a hand in hand with the progress of free and democratic accountable governments around the world and our ability to address these problems with technological solutions.
Well, the Chinese government, communist government, suppresses information. What would be their motivation?
Well, they want control. They want to keep control of the flow of information so that they keep political control. And I think, you know, again, this is a part of this debate about whether democracy comes from technological openness or not, you know, whether the internet will inevitably sweep in. Well, I think the Chinese example has been pretty instructive so far. They've figured out a lot of ways to use communications technology and the internet to reinforce their control. Most Chinese are not so yearning so heavily for political freedom and political expression.
But how do we know that?
Well, we don't really know that, but it appears that, you know, even though they could get around some of the barriers that have been put in place by the Chinese government, they don't take the time to because they don't really care that much. And so it turns out that it's a lot easier to use these kinds of great firewall kinds of restraints on freedom to affect authoritarianism. So this is, I think, an example. Technology will not in and of itself bring freedom to China. We have to have a political struggle for freedom in China as well.
Sure. Why do you think your mother was so enthusiastic? I don't mean to take a dig at her, but you know, a lot of people were actually enthusiastic about communism, and she was forward-looking, and I don't mean to say anything negative about her, but why do you think so many people around the world in the 60s, for example, were actually quite sympathetic, even the New York Times, with this system, which clearly, I'm talking about the authoritarian communist system or any kind of despotic government, which clearly moves to suppress new technologies, new ideas. You know, if you go to China today or Cuba, where I've been, you don't see new fancy gadgets all over the place, obviously.
Well, just to clear my mother's name, mom was never a communist.
No, I'm not saying she was, but she seemed to be impressed with the progressive nature of these governments. But of course, in practice, it proved to be a little more complex.
Well, there was only really one government that she was impressed by, and that was revolutionary Cuba from 1959 to 1960 or so, she visited them.
Yeah.
She was part of the National Student Association and the student body president of Ohio State University, so she was invited down to see what the Cuban Revolution was accomplishing and, of course, was on a very limited exposure basis of what they were going to show any of those kids down there. And she was very impressed until then they announced that they were Marxist-Leninists 6 months later or something.
But you see my point. In all respect to your mother, a lot of people can be seduced by this idea that we're going to have progress. And I guess, one of the reasons I called you up is because I think we will have progress, but it certainly won't be through these means that everybody seemed to be quite seduced by back in the 60s.
Well, if by these means you mean lining counter-revolutionaries up against the wall and shooting them, I think you're quite right. Sometimes, Glenn Beck does inspire a certain kind of revolutionary thought in my mind, I have to confess.
I agree. Hey,
but, I'm still of a mind that democracy in almost all circumstances can be achieved through relatively nonviolent means.
Yeah.
But in the end, all governance is the legitimate control of a force in an area. And there are going to be times and places where revolutionary means have to be used.
Sure.
I don't think that the Burmese generals are going to give up power without some kind of violent conflict.
No, of course not.
The Chinese Communist Party is probably not going to go quietly.
Yeah.
So I think that there are times and places. But in general, I think that we've had a lot of success in the last 20 years with democratic reestablishment of democracy in Eastern Europe and other places. So, I'm pretty optimistic about that.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm just speculating here, but, maybe the most important development in the past 50 years or so has been the exponential growth of power of the semiconductor technology, which, a few people, Moore and these other guys understood back 30, 40 years ago. But, most people, as you and I realize, they wake up in the morning and they're not sure where this is taking us. And of course, Ray Kurzweil is aware, but I'm not sure, it's actually the power of the technology which is going to catapult us. It's going to be just our understanding of our brain power and being able to come up with a better knowledge about how things work. You see where I'm going with this type of question. Are we, because I think you were quoted in the New York Times as saying he's hijacked the singularity thesis.
What
did you mean by that?
Well, it's always a problem talking to the media because, you talk to a reporter for an hour and then they use one sentence. But I was actually referring to, in the first place, I don't consider myself a singularitarian in that regard.
Yeah.
I'm not a part of that subculture, which I consider to be quasi-religious, which is okay. I'm just not a member of that sect.
Okay. I didn't think you were. That's why I brought it up.
Right. There are rival sects of singularitarians, and not all of them are happy with the fact that Ray Kurzweil has become the public face of their doctrine, because they have different interpretations of what it means.
Okay.
So there's another sect out there that around the Singularity Institute who believe that the singularity should be defined solely as the advent of greater than human intelligence, and that that will bootstrap itself into godhood in a very short period of time, is for them the defining characteristic of the singularity. And if and therefore acceleration is irrelevant to them.
You know,
Kurzweil's, all of Kurzweil's charts and his predictions and everything are irrelevant to them because they don't think that you can really predict when we make these critical breakthroughs to create self-aware, self-improving, recursive intelligence. Mm. And there are others who simply think that this is a matter of unpredictable technological change, which will pass some threshold. And they similarly don't like Kurzweil's certainty about the time frame or the focus on greater than human artificial intelligence. They think it could be nanotechnology, it could be genetic engineering, and so forth.
Yeah.
So what I was saying to the Times was that, you know, Kurzweil has certainly popularized the term and a certain set of ideas.
Yeah.
But there are other aspirants to that lead that movement.
Sure. So he's kind of got the big public forum, and he discusses it, and he's associated now with it more than anybody else.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And, but the idea itself comes from where? I mean, maybe 40, 50 years ago, some computer scientist was thinking about this.
Again, if it depends on which sect you follow, but you know, some of them go back to A.J. Good's ideas about the recursively self-improving nature of intelligence, that you could have an intelligence explosion, and this is something written in the 50s.
Okay.
Others would go back to Werner Vinge's essay that he wrote for NASA back in early 1990s, where he was arguing, and where he coined the term singularity in its modern usage. And he was arguing, again, for artificial intelligence, but also emphasizing with the very term singularity, the unknowability of what the future might hold beyond that point.
Right.
So there are different kinds of histories depending on, you know, whether you go back to Paul or the John the Baptist or Jesus.
You know, I'm 51 now, and so I can remember back in the my high school days, you know, there was a lot of discussion, serious discussion, by serious folks that, you know, robots would in time, say in a couple of decades, would kind of be dominating human society. You know, we'd have a lot of robots working for us. And I remember what it was about a year ago that the Sony Corporation had a lot of research in R&D spending on robotics, and they dumped it. You know, they just basically gave up. You know, we don't really have a lot of robots flying around today, do we?
Nope, we don't.
Now, does this sort of sober up your mind about, you know, maybe we're a little enthusiastic about things that we shouldn't be enthusiastic about?
Well, part of the problem is that our vision of the future was that there would be these humanoid robots, self-aware, that we could talk to, that would be doing all these tasks.
Yeah.
And that the future turned out to be that instead you had robotics coded into a chip that do tasks for you if you tell it to.
Yeah. So, but these are not replicating the human animal.
Right. Well, they extend humans, but they don't replicate.
Yeah.
You know, my cell phone is 10 times smarter than anything imagined in artificial intelligence in the science fiction of the 60s, but it doesn't think for me. Right. And I really wouldn't want it to think for me. So I think, you know, the sexiness of the idea of a humanoid friend or butler, robo butler, is just not something that there's really a market for. We don't really want things that, you know, we don't want a toaster that doesn't want to serve you toast because it thinks that you're putting on pounds and that you should be on a low carb diet.
Right.
We want a toaster that just makes toast when you tell it to.
Right.
And you want a phone that doesn't talk back. So at any rate, I think our nature of robotics has needed to shift to what people really need, which is artificial intelligence coded into things to do the things that we want them to do. And that they're doing very well.
You know, I guess a lot of the excitement about the computing technology and computing power was really based on the fact that some people, a guy like Kurzweil, would predict, okay, the computer is going to beat the master chess champions, you know, the masters. And of course, at some point, the computer actually did. And so, you know, maybe that's the idea, that the computing power that we're going to be developing will at some point really excel and go way beyond the human capacity. That, you know, is that true, do you think, James? Or do you think we're, again, are we, is this wrong, a concept? You know, what do you think is correct?
Well, my hope is that we will use technology to extend human capacity and that we will always stay ahead of technological capacity. I'm not so concerned about whether computers do things better than human beings do, because they already do. I mean, computers add better than we do. They play chess better than we do. They do all kinds of, you know, control traffic.
Yeah.
But I'm not concerned about that, because the computers aren't trying to tell us what to do.
Okay.
They don't have wills of their own.
Right.
You know, unless you're truly paranoid, but I don't think they do.
Sure.
And so as long as technology extends human capacity, and, you know, the ultimate vision of that is Kurzweil's notion that we might have nanorobots in our brains, which hook us into computers, we'd have Google on access all the time and be able to back up our personalities. As long as there's no computer out there telling my brain what to think, and my brain is telling computers what to think, that's great.
Sure.
So that's the vision of the future that I hope we have.
Okay.
But I think there is the possibility. It's not a negligible possibility that we would develop self-willed artificial intelligence, which could be a threat to the human future.
That's sort of what your research is all about, right? I mean, how to control these negative developments. For example, these computer scientists like Kurzweil think actually we could reverse engineer the human brain. I frankly think that's way off. You know, that's going to be difficult. But, you know, they do think that it can be done. So maybe at some point we will have the merging of human brain technology, call it what you will, the human brain, and our artificial technology or synthetic machines.
Yes. Well, like convergence between genetic engineering and nanotechnology, it may be that what we are thinking of as artificial intelligence and our own brains may converge. So the distinctions that I'm making between self-willed behavior in an artificial intelligence and the self-willed nature of our brains may be a moot distinction in the future. The two may have merged so deeply that that they're the same thing.
Hmm. So the real thrust of your research today is on the sociological implications of this change that we're inevitably going to see because of powerful technologies.
Well, what I'm working on right now is a book called Cyborg Buddha, which is about the impacts of neurotechnologies on our capacity for moral behavior and for religious and spiritual experience.
Mm.
I'm a former Buddhist monk, and there are several Buddhists involved in the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and we're interested in these spiritual questions and moral questions of neurotechnologies.
Mm-hmm.
After that, we're working on a project on the impacts on sex, parenting, and reproduction, and there's all kinds of implications for these technologies around the world. We also have a project on risk mitigation around global catastrophic risks.
Mm.
So.
Well, you know, what about the effect on young people, these technologies? Because, for example, I mean, I would sympathize deeply with your mother that the outrage that we have, and I'm sure, you know, you were feeling the same way when Reagan came in and the inequality started to burgeon. But, you know, young people today are facing very unequal platforms. You know, you got the rich folks in Connecticut who might end up in Yale, and then you've got the poor folks in wherever they are, you know, around the world and in the U.S., and their chances of intellectually developing themselves or, you know, their brain power are pretty diminished compared to the rich folks. So isn't this a really big issue for someone like you or me? You know, this is kind of the future, isn't it? Because this brain power we have in the first 20 years of development is really extraordinary. And yet, you know, we find young people graduating from high school who really are almost functionally illiterate.
Well, I give a chapter in Citizen Cyborg to intelligence augmentation and the capacity for increasing our intelligence, our memory, other cognitive capabilities.
Yeah.
And the general point that I make there is that most of the improvements that we can effect in cognitive capacity around the world are going to be through better nutrition, better education, smaller family sizes, those kinds of things.
Okay.
When you get to affluent people in the industrialized countries, however, you're beginning to max out, at least at the top range of affluent access to good education, good nutrition, health care, and so forth.
Right.
You're beginning to max out what you can accomplish with the genetic capabilities that each kid is given. If you want to increase intelligence at that range, it has to be some kind of fundamental redesign of the cognitive apparatus at a genetic level, different kinds of neurochemicals involved, and so basically the kinds of smart drugs and genetic engineering that we imagine for the future. So I think...
Are you worried that these inequalities are going to mean a serious peril to us?
Well, I think they're already not so great for the world. They are a huge drag on international productivity. There's countries where, so many people have been cognitively damaged by malnutrition and chronic stress from civil conflicts and so forth that, their whole generations lost in their capacity to become, highly productive workers.
Yeah.
And I think it also is very bad for democracy. I think that, where the smarter a citizen is, the more capable they are of holding the powerful accountable and participating as fully empowered citizens. So, so I think it's good all around if we could get people smarter.
Do you find that the men in power are using technology to their advantage, that they understand it and try to suppress the aspirations of everybody out there, trying to do what the, these more despotic governments in Cuba or North Korea or China could try to do already?
Well, I don't think
that... Is the George Bush, in your opinion, sort of in the style that these guys, you probably see what my question is, James.
Well, I don't think that there are very many political leaders who have openly expressed a desire to keep their citizens stupid, but I think that by the effect of their policies, there are certain lack of enthusiasm for the kinds of policies that might actually make generations of the future more intelligent and
I agree with
improve
you.
Their cognitive capacities.
I really agree with you. Wouldn't you think that this is a serious problem?
It is it's an enormous problem. I mean, I see it as part of a general problem of the weakness of investments in the human capital of kids.
Exactly. That's probably the theme of this interview, because I think in some respects, if we want to develop the society that you dream of, we're going to have to do these. We're going to have to make these investments in human capital, in young people.
Absolutely.
Now, the question is, how do we develop the technology to do it, and what technology should we emphasize in our R&D? You see, I mean, because we're spending a lot of money on this stuff in general, but maybe we're not spending it in the right way or in the right place.
Well, again, it's not just a technological issue. I mean, I think as we see with educational technology, if you just roll out new laptops to every kid without thinking about how they get integrated into the curriculum, how teachers need to be trained to use them, it just doesn't improve anything. In fact, it's just a distraction. They use them to send email and get on Facebook, but they don't do anything else with them. So we need, and at the social level, you need a real investment, an attitude of investment in kids and their futures. And not all governments or political leaders are really oriented that way. So, I see it as a part of a larger political struggle to get people excited again about civic engagement and about the capacities of governments to improve the welfare of their citizens. And there's been a tremendous amount of pessimism engendered about that over the last 50 years.
Yeah. I won't keep you much longer, James, but so you're not really all that concerned about the United States in decline and, say, Asia, in particular China, on the rise. I mean, you know, this doesn't necessarily, this is sort of exaggerated in your opinion?
Well, each country is a different case, but I'm not terribly concerned about China because the demographic imbalance between the generation that is workers now that will soon start retiring, you know, in the next couple decades, and their, because of their one-child policy and the, and even beyond the one-child policy, the decline in fertility in China of, you know, intentional fertility, has meant that they're just going to have a huge demographic burden.
Okay.
There also have 17 different ethnic groups, which have all had, you know, burbling aspirations for self expression, for national independence, the Tibetans being the most notable, but many others, the Uyghurs and so forth. And they closed down internet access in the Uyghur territories for an entire, you know, like 6 months because they didn't want news of the Uyghur Han conflicts getting out. And you have wildcat strikes happening this whole last week in China. There are wildcat strikes all over the nation. So I think China has a whole lot of issues that it's as soon as the lid comes off, it's going to have to deal with.
I agree with
India has huge infrastructure problems. It most of Indians are not benefiting from the growing wealth of the middle classes. It has huge problems. The rest of the world has huge problems. The United States has problems, but I don't think that the you know, compared to the problems everybody else has got, I don't think our problems are out of whack. So.
Yeah, true. I agree with you. Now, what about your general or whatever you might want to call it, overall vision of the future? Say, you know, let's imagine that you and I live really long, you know, maybe 110 years old, and say we're talking to each other, and I hope we will be. Say in 15, 20, 30 years from now, you know, 25 years. In 25 years, James, what kind of world do you think we will be, living in?
I can't even speculate anymore. I mean, I know that I'm supposed to be a futurist and that this is our stock and trade.
Yeah.
But, I didn't foresee the collapse of the stock market and the collapse of the housing market. And I didn't foresee the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, I was younger then. But there are just so many things. Imponderables in the nature of human affairs, I can't really foresee it. But in any particular area, you know, whether we'll have genetic engineering within 5 or 10 years, you can make a kind of a guess. But what the implications, as we said earlier, what the implications of that might be, who knows?
You know, you probably heard of Nassim Taleb. He authored The Black Swan. You know, he argues that, some of these big events are truly, totally, unforeseen, completely unforeseen, and they, you know, he calls them black swans. Does that sort of resonate with you, that idea?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the notion of unforeseeable events out there is a given. And it's one of the reasons why I emphasize the concept of resilience increasingly is that I think there are some big unforeseeables that may have very small likelihoods, but that could be such civilization inhibitors, you know, that what you say, like Kurzweil looks at the history of the last couple hundred years and says that there's been this trend of technological acceleration that nothing seems to have stopped, you know, wars, depressions, and so on. Well, if we had another Black Death, something on that order, I think it would put a crimp in some of the expectations of technological progress.
Oh, no question.
I think we need to be thinking a lot more seriously about ourselves as a highly complex organism that needs some redundancy.
I wanted to wind it up. Hey, James, it's great to talk to you. We should probably do a series of interviews, and I thank you so much for the time.
You as well.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.